On Thursday, November 6, 1913, the Detroit News was forecasting moderate to brisk winds on the Great Lakes. On Friday, the Port Huron Times-Herald predicted a moderately severe storm. But hourly, the warnings became more and more dire, and by the time it became clear that a freshwater hurricane of epic proportions was developing, the storm was then well on its way to becoming the deadliest in Great Lakes maritime history, which over the course of 4 days sank, stranded, or demolished dozens of boats and claimed the lives of up to 250 sailors. Michael Schumacher, our next guest, has written 12 books and 25 documentaries on Great Lakes shipwrecks and lighthouses. He lives in Wisconsin and joins us now by phone to talk about his most recent book, November's Fury, The Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913. Michael Schumacher, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
You know, I'd like to start out by just asking you the general question, how did you become interested in storms and shipwrecks?
I've lived on the Great Lakes pretty much my whole life. I was raised in Milwaukee, and now I live in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I'm 5 minutes from the lake, from Lake Michigan, and I visit that lake every day, and that's the truth. If I'm in town, I go to the lake just to sit for a little bit or whatever. So and I don't know why this is, incidentally, but I have a real passion for the Great Lakes and for this region of the country. And so it was kind of natural for me when I started reading about these shipwrecks, and I probably read the same books that every other enthusiast did over the years. You wanted to know more. I'd heard, for example, about this 1913 storm, but I wanted to know more. Now, other books have been written about that storm, or they've been talked about the storm in other books. I wanted to do my own. And the same with the Carl Bradley or the Edmund Fitzgerald or the one I'm working on now, the Daniel J. Morrell. These were all storied shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. So I was very interested in that. That's the best answer I can have for it.
It's well, that's a great answer, and I think it's one that our listeners understand because, as you know, we sit right on the shore of on the north shore of Lake Superior, and
right.
are very familiar with the storms of November and some of the history. I mean, I have to admit, I didn't know about this until I read your book about the storm of 1913 in November. I didn't know any details about it at any rate, but you certainly present a very interesting tale of that storm. And I think you've already answered my next question, which was, why did you write this book now? there were gaps, I gather, that you saw, or a chance to do something more with that story.
Sure. Plus, it's the centennial. You know, I mean, it's one of those things where publishers certainly love anniversary dates and so forth.
Sure.
So it made sense to do it at that time. And you're absolutely right. I'm always amazed by people remember the Fitzgerald storm, for example, or some of the older ones might even remember the Carl Bradley, or they've heard about the Great Armistice Day storm in 1940. But this one, for some reason, or even the Matafa storm in 1905, because the Matafa became one of the most celebrated shipwrecks, you know, in maritime history.
Is that the one
Great
that
Lake
went ashore by Duluth?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And
yeah, you cover
people,
that.
You know, people remember these, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know why they don't tend to remember the storm in 1913, because that was the, as they would say, the mother of all Great Lakes storms.
Yeah. How did you research it?
Well, I used probably a lot of the same research materials that other people have used in researching this. The Port Huron newspaper, for example, covered it very, very extensively because so many shipwrecks occurred down there at the bottom of Lake Huron near Port Huron.
Yeah, why don't you describe a little bit where Port Huron is?
That's at the southern end of Lake Huron. And by that, I mean it's on the eastern shore in Michigan, and it's a big shipping town. And what had happened with this storm is that when winds are coming out of the north on both Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, if they go unabated for a long period of time, they build up massive waves at the bottom of the lake. In other words, I've heard sailors told me stories about waves they saw trying to go into the Chicago Harbor, that, you know, massive waves. And in this case, these winds went not only unabated, but they were at an extremely high, you know, miles per hour for many, many hours, 14 hours, I believe, if I recall correctly. They were over 50-mile-an-hour winds for 14 solid hours. So that allowed the waves to build up down toward the bottom of Lake Huron. Now you had all these boats that were going, you know, that were on Lake Huron at the bottom that just really stood no chance against this storm. They were flipped, broken. It's really, when you think of the power of these waves, and I write about that at one point in the book, quoting Sebastian Junger, the author of Perfect Storm, about how much power just a 10-foot wave, for example, can generate. You know, 10 foot high, 50 feet long, and I believe traveling at 32 miles an hour, it's well over a million pounds of pressure.
And 10 feet was a little ripple compared to what they had out there.
Absolutely. And one of the captains said he saw one that he would estimate was 70 feet. Now, that's pretty extreme for the Great Lakes. But 30 to 40-foot waves certainly were the norm in this storm. And incidentally, these were the same size waves that brought down the Fitzgerald or brought down the Carl Bradley. These massive waves that are just absolutely assaulting these boats. One of the boats, the captain turned around and saw this massive wave coming over the back of the boat, over the stern of the boat, and he yelled, you know, look out, here comes a big one. And he and his first mate dove down the gangway or the stairs leading up to the pilot house, or they would have been killed because this wave hit the pilot house and just wiped it out.
Yeah,
it's hard for us to believe, but it, you know, when you think of these big boats built out of steel and everything, but these waves generate an awful lot of power.
Yeah, why don't you? You know, that was kind of interesting to me on the size of the vessels that were already sailing the Great Lakes back in 1913.
Sure.
Describe those the typical ore carrier, let's say.
Sure. Well, it was funny because this was right about the time in the early. Right after the first of the century, they started building more and more boats out of steel rather than wood. In the 19th century, a lot of the boats, or all of the boats, essentially, were built out of wood. Mm-hmm. And you were used to seeing schooners, you know, two- and three-masted schooners out there in the water carrying, you know, cargo. Well, with these long ships that were created out of steel, flat bottom so they can handle the waves better, you know, the stormy weather on the lakes. They were literally like floating warehouses. There was this massive, long area of cargo hold. And then you had a deck, you know, or two houses in the front and the back, you know, in the front where you had the pilot house and the captain's quarters and so forth, and in the back where you had the engine room quarters. And the engines were in the back of the boats, and they were, you know, it's important to remember, too, with this storm, these engines were the best that were built at the time, but they were woefully inadequate when it came to taking on waves of this nature. They just, they were powerless.
Yeah, so you describe a number of captain's accounts of the power, you know, not being able to go forward into
right.
into the waves, and then having to try to turn around and with inadequate power was extremely dangerous, it sounds like.
It was, and I think it's significant, I think it's significant that one boat traveling north on Lake Huron made it.
Yeah.
What was the name of that boat? Grounded or you know, headed for cover.
Yeah, and that captain sort of didn't have kind things to say about the other sailors, did he? What exactly did he say? Do you remember that story?
Yeah, some of these captains couldn't believe these guys were out there.
Right.
You know, this was a strange storm, as you pointed out at the onset of our conversation. No one knew the severity of this storm. When it hit the Upper Lakes, meaning Superior and Michigan, it did a lot of destruction, and the sailors were prepared to stay in. It looked like, after 2 days, it was blowing out, which was normal for the Great Lakes. Well, it picked back up because this storm that had caused so much grief on the northern lakes, you know, the Upper Lakes, was joined by another storm front that was coming from the southeast, from Georgia. It rolled up the seaboard like they usually do, and rather than go out to sea, out to the Atlantic Ocean as normal, it took a turn to the Ohio Valley. And so these sailors would get out on the lakes thinking they were safe, but the storm was dying down, and they found themselves in the worst ever. And the one quote that I liked, excuse me, a little cold here, the one quote that I liked from that particular description of the storm was the guy was going to church, and he says, "When I went into church on that Sunday morning, the lake was flat as glass. When I came out, no one was safe on that lake."
Amazing.
The waves had whipped up that quickly and that heavily in so little time. You know, so it was something that no one was really, the national weather people was certainly, the Weather Bureau was certainly overmatched here. They were predicting the best they could. We also did not, they recognized that hurricanes could occur on the lake. In other words, we usually associate them with things, say, in the Gulf of Mexico or tropical storms. But there are certain standards or certain requirements for something to be considered a hurricane. For wind velocity, for duration, and so forth. And this, they had a flag, a hurricane flag that they never flew. They'd fly a flag that said a gale to warn, you know, people, look out for a real rough ride here. But a hurricane was a whole different story. And they were just loath to post that particular flag. And they didn't in this case because they expected it was going to be rough, even gale force, but not hurricane force, which is exactly what happened.
Well, let me just pause for a minute to tell our listeners that I'm speaking with Michael Schumacher here on the Roadhouse from WTIP in Grand Marais. We're talking about Michael's book, recently released by the University of Minnesota Press, about November's Fury, the dangerous storm, hurricane, actually, of November of 1913. You know, you describe so many little vignettes of the different ships and what was happening on them. It's just kind of fascinating the way you did that. And you describe some of the vulnerabilities or what sunk the various vessels. Can you give us some of the biggest vulnerabilities of those vessels in that day?
Well, one thing they found out later, and I mean much later, a half century later, when the Daniel J. Morrell went down in 1966, and earlier the Carl Bradley, both of those boats split into two pieces and sank, you know, in two pieces. And what they discovered was that the construction, the steel used in the construction of vessels prior to 1948, and that would have included, obviously, all the boats we're talking about here, mm-hmm. The steel in there wasn't as flexible in cold, you know, water as the stuff when they used a better type of material. And so these boats would be brittle, so to speak. And they also weren't welded. They were riveted. And those rivets would pop when they started to flex, as they're supposed to do. They would pop, and you'd lose, you know, these sailors were talking about, you'd go down below decks after a storm and you'd be picking these rivets up by the bucket load. And if it was serious, sailors were known to take broom handles and put them in the holes where the rivets were and saw them off just to hold it together as well as they could till they reached port. So there were the construction aspects of it that actually set this storm apart.
And you describe how that happens is that the wave is so huge that the bow or the stern comes way out of the water.
That was one of the things that really made me. I was actually kind of awed when I read some of these engineer reports after the storm when they talked about the stern of the ship would come be lifted out of the water. Now the propeller without the resistance of the water starts to spin really fast. So when the boat was slammed back into the water after the wave passed, it would shudder. The whole ship would shudder like it was going to fall apart. So they would be the stern would come out of the water. The propellers spinning, you know, much much faster. And in the meantime, the guy in the engine room was checking down, so to speak, get that revolution down. Well, what happened was obviously you're in doing this. Now you're losing all your power forward with the boat because it's going at a much slower pace, the screw, so to speak. And so these guys would find themselves like standing still in the water, just trying to make any progress at all in this storm while they're being assaulted by these waves. I think, you know, there's certain things that just surprised me, I guess, when I was working on the book. Yeah. The idea that a boat could be grounded and then just torn apart by waves. You know, you think you're safe, you're out of the worst of it. Well, not necessarily.
Yeah, that happened to several vessels in the southern part of Lake Huron, didn't it?
Exactly. So the one that I got a kick out of, when you obviously no one was injured or killed in this thing. So you could afford to kind of smile when you look at these pictures. His smokestack is sitting on his deck. The wave just ripped the smokestack right off the boat.
Yeah.
And there it is, sitting in the middle, and you go, well, that's a little irregular. But you know what I'm saying? You look at this kind of stuff, and you're going, my Lord, these guys were pounded. And, you know, it would come through and just absolutely break anything that was glass on the boat. There was no glass left on these ships, you know, after the hurricane, yeah, if they made it in safely, you know, it just dismantled these things.
Okay, roughly how many vessels went down not to be found again?
There are several that haven't been found yet.
And there have been discoveries long after the storm, right?
I love the one just recently. Yeah. It actually affected my book.
Yeah, I saw
that. Smith.
Right. Yeah, that was the very last story in your book.
Edited. We were all ready to roll, and then they found the ship.
Yeah, that was interesting because
thanks a lot, guys.
We actually interesting for us too because we talked to those Jerry Eliason, I think is his name.
Yeah, great
from
guy, and Ken Merriman.
Yeah, Jerry is the guy we interviewed on the Roadhouse here after that discovery was announced.
Isn't that something?
And then to see him show up here at the end of your book was pretty cool.
Well, we were chatting when I saw them up at the Gales of November conference in Duluth. When was that conference? It was either early November or late October.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, things have gone so fast I can't remember, but he was great. I enjoyed talking to him.
Well, I wish we had a lot more time to talk to you, but we're running low here, and I wonder if you can just answer me, if this storm were to occur now, what would the result be in comparison?
Well, it wouldn't be as devastating in the respect that we have such better weather forecasting. Could a storm, it's the question that I'm asked fairly often, could something like this happen again?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the storm, of course. You know,
yep.
It was the worst, but could it happen again? Well, if it happened once, it could happen again. But what happens now is we have weather. There were no jet streams in those days. You know, they didn't know about jet streams. There were no jets. The weather reporting was so rudimentary. You know, they knew something about fronts, but what they really reported was wind velocity, wind direction, temperature, precipitation, you know, and barometer. Those five things. Well, now they can tell you way in advance. Here's the storm. Here's how it's moving.
Yeah.
Get off the water.
And all the captains have the lessons that were learned by those poor souls that, that went down in that storm.
So absolutely.
They don't want to repeat that.
I don't think any captain, you know, you hear a lot of cynics out there say, well, they'll go out in anything. No captain that I've ever talked to, you know, now obviously they're going to say this, but I believe it's true. Nobody will go out if they think there's danger to their vessel or their men. But these guys simply did not believe that it was going to be life-threatening. They thought, as did the captain of the Henry Smith, that it was going to be a bad ride. They were going to get bounced around pretty bad, but they'd be okay.
And they found out otherwise. And there was only one captain who was right about that, and he did make it up the lake.
Yeah.
But most of them, that was not true. Well, we've been talking here with Michael Schumacher, whose book, November's Fury, The Deadly Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913, is on bookstore shelves right now. And I'm sure you can look up Michael online and learn where you can pick up a copy of his book. Michael, have you got anything else to add about that?
I don't know where I would start.
Okay. No, how about getting your book? Is it out generally now?
Yeah, it's out everywhere. You can get it online if you go to Amazon or the usual. Because I am who I am, I love the mom-and-pop bookstores. I love the little ones. Order them through your local little bookstore and give them some nickels.
Agree. Okay, Michael, thank you very much for joining us here. I'm sure the listeners appreciated hearing your stories.